Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Michael Shikashio. Michael CDBC is the past president of the International Association of Animal Behaviour Consultants, the IAABC, and provides private consultations working exclusively with dog aggression cases through his business, Complete Canines LLC. Michael is fully certified through the IAABC and is a full member of the Association of Professional Dog Trainers, the APDT. He also offers mentoring and training to other professionals. Michael is sought after for his expert opinion by numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, New York Post, Baltimore Sun, WebMD, Women's Health Magazine, Real Simple Magazine, The Chronicle of the Dog, and Steve Dale's Pet World. He is a featured speaker on the topic of canine aggression at conferences and seminars around the world, and he currently teaches aggression cases A to Z through the Dog Trainers Connection and the Aggression in Dogs Mentorship through the IAABC. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Michael to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Michael, how are you?
Great, Ryan. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be doing this podcast for sure. I've heard some of your podcasts and people speak great things about it, and very excited to be one of your guests. So
equally excited. And Michael, thank you for taking time today out of your schedule to come and hang out with us. It's really appreciated. And not just that, we appreciate that you and I caught up about a month or so ago and we've been sending emails back and forth. So thank you for all the time you've dedicated to this. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Awesome. And let's dive in to the first question today. Michael, could you please take everyone listening back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training and share some stories from that time and some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
So, yeah, I think what a lot of trainers know as a crossover trainer, so someone that started using different methods or aversive methods in my initial training. And I started to want to learn more about training and more about behavior. A lot of that was because I was fostering a lot of dogs early on. I was volunteering for some various rescues. And, you know, once they start realizing you're a good foster home, they start sending you more and more difficult dogs. And that's where I caught like the behavior bug and wanted to learn more about behavior and different methods. So I did as most people do, went online and used Google and sort of came across what is mostly now defunct Yahoo Groups, which some trainers out there might remember, but sort of very similar to the Facebook groups we have now for dog behavior and dog training discussion. But what I realized was that a lot of what I was doing was not well received in a lot of those groups, and I had at the time did not know about different training methods only because of what I'd learned from either apprenticing with other trainers, or I'd actually attended a dog training school way back then, and it was sort of a traditional dog training type of approach. And I didn't realize that there was other methods. So I got scolded a few times on those groups, and it made me kind of start digging into things. And some trainers were very helpful, actually, and gave me some reading suggestions. And so that's when I actually started to read my first positive training book, which was Gene Donaldson's The Culture Clash, which is sort of a seminal classic in the positive reinforcement dog training world. And then it kind of just took off from there. Once I read that, I started diving into all the other classic books back then, like Don't Shoot the Dog, and books similar to that, you know, all about training and behavior. And that was my first exposure to it. And then I attended my first Clicker Expo, and then I eventually attended my first IAABC conference, and it just kind of took off from there. So it wasn't a quick switch, like you're flicking on a light switch to make me change. But over time, of course, my methods have changed to what they are today. So it was gradual, but I'm glad that I was exposed to it at least then.
And so you jumped on these antique Yahoo groups, and you started to share a little bit about what you were doing with the foster dogs at the time. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And that was based on more traditional methodology.
Yes, yeah. I was doing what I was imitating what I saw on TV, and learning, applying what I learned, read in some of the older books, and from one of my original mentor trainers, who was sort of a military style dog trainer. And so that's all I knew at the time, and that's what I was applying. But the beauty of having foster dogs is that you get to live with it, number one, because they're with you 24/7, but you also get to really hone your training chops or your training skills, because you have these foster dogs that have these behavior issues, or and you get to kind of learn very quickly through hands-on work with foster dogs. And I always recommend that to trainers too, is to, if you really want to get good hands-on experience, have the dogs living with you under your own roof, or volunteer at shelters, of course, but that hands-on experience is unbeatable with fostering dogs.
Yeah, awesome. And so this experience of doing all this foster work, joining these Yahoo groups, getting feedback from these groups.
Yes.
led you to find books like The Culture Clash. So can you share a story from that time and when you started to receive this new information and started to reflect on it compared to what you were doing? Can you share a story with maybe one of the animals you started working with at that time?
You know what? One of the first dogs I was fostering, I want to say the first dog, so maybe it was about the 12th or 13th dog I was fostering, this little beagle. And, it's like beagles do, they nose to the ground and they're pulling on the leash. And, as what I was trying to train was him to walk on a loose leash. And I was using a pinch collar at that time. And I put the pinch collar on, and I used it just like I had with other dogs, but I had worked mostly with labs because I was volunteering for a lab rescue. I used the pinch collar in the same way I used with the labs. And it really, really affected me how this beagle yelped. He just yelped and was screaming at the horrific experience he just had. And that really made me think very deeply about what I was doing, and that there had to be other ways. And so I kind of went on. That's sort of what I went on to some of the more positive groups that I was discovering and explaining things. And some people were very nice and some others were not very happy with me, but that's all, that was my learning experience. And so I think that beagle taught me a lot, about just, it's there's two ends to that leash and not just the one that I was used to being on.
And did you get an opportunity with that individual animal to, based on the feedback you got, try other strategies?
Yes. Yeah, I started using food with that dog. I got rid of the pinch collar and I started using food, albeit very sloppily. It's my first time using kind of this lure and reward system that I started with back then. And with beagles, that's an added challenge sometimes. But it was a complete change for me with that beagle anyways, with that dog. And that's what really started my shift towards using reinforcers in dog training.
Awesome. And I'm going to use you as a guinea pig, Michael, and test a new question on you. And sure. the reason I say this is because your story is one that's shared by lots of trainers. And there is acknowledgement that having gone through that period of using aversive methods potentially puts you in a powerful position now to help others more because you understand both sides of the coin. So my new question that I want to test with you is, if you could go back to that time period, could go back through everything you've done up until today, and especially that early time in your life, if there was one thing you could do differently back then, what do you think that might be?
What would I do differently knowing what I know now, or what would I do?
Yeah, just like, I don't know. We're teasing this out. interpret my question how you will and go with that.
Well, certainly if I was if I knew what I knew now and I could go back and talk to the old Mike, I would give him a good schooling on you know, the different way we can change behavior without using aversives. Yeah, it's, if I could change anything, you know, I would certainly, you know, reach for those reinforcers or learn how to use those first. But, you know, we're a product of what we are exposed to, you know, and that's why when I'm working with trainers now, or I'm giving my classes online or my seminars, I never fault anybody for anything in terms of their training. It's what we're exposed to. We're a product of what we learn and what's, you know, just as the animals we train, we're a product of the environment. And our behavior is reflecting that. So, you know, it is what we're exposed to, and that's why whenever I have somebody that might be using a method that I don't agree with, or others might find offensive, I would I never criticize that, you know, because I know I really appreciated the trainers that sort of took me under their wing at the time when I was making that crossover. And so it's this, I promise myself, and I always do the same, is if I find somebody that just wants to learn, if you're willing to learn, I'm willing to teach and I'm willing to show, and without criticizing. And that's how I'd approach the old Mike if the present day Mike was to go talk to him.
Maybe that's the better question next time. What would you say to the younger you if you could go back?
Yeah, I like that question. Makes you think.
Let's unpack this a little bit more just before we move on, because we can acknowledge, I think, that as positive reinforcement practitioners and as people who teach others and have clients, we are often in that position where we see someone whom we could easily judge and throw our knowledge of positive reinforcement out the window and yeah. Proceed in that conversation. What advice might you be able to give just to build upon everything you've just added there? How did you get to this thought process you have now? Were you always able to just easily accept that and help people learn? Or have there been some turning points which have helped guide your ability to control your emotions? Is that a correct way of saying that?
Yeah. I think one of the things I've learned to do from a couple of people that I've learned from over the years, both Dr. Susan Friedman and Risa Van Fleet, and that's using empathy. Because we don't know what people are going through. We don't know what's in their mindset. We don't know, especially in aggression cases. My clients are often, they're already filled with the emotion because it's often they're facing difficult decisions. So being empathetic and understanding that they may be making decisions not quite based on rational thoughts. They might be very emotional. They are under a high state of stress. And just like the animals we teach, if they are under high state of stress, they may be displaying behaviors reflecting that. So the same thing with my clients is that I always go in with empathy, and I've come across some really difficult things that clients might be doing with their pets, and it's important to understand that sometimes that's all they know, or that's what they're trying. They're desperate to try to fix the problem, and so being a good listener, listening to their side of the story, listening to what they're going through, is something I focus on a lot in my consultations to make sure I understand where they're coming from, rather than quickly judging why they're behaving the way they are with their animals. So yeah, I think empathy is a skill that all animal trainers should have, because most of us do it well with the animals. We also need to do it well with the people.
And so you mentioned it's kind of like thinking in a comparative way that how would we behave if our animals were in a stressful situation. So I think that's useful. Is it kind of trying to put your clients below threshold?
In a way, yes. I think I think we need to be aware of their stress levels too, and I know we might not be able to read their body language as we can our own species that we train sometimes, but I think it's important to consider that there is that side of the equation as well. We have to, especially in aggression cases, there's a lot of emotion involved, and people can often try to mask those emotions or act, or sometimes they behave in a way that may not be how they would normally respond in a certain situation. So, I have like an amazing couple of cases this week. There's an amount of that people will tolerate or not tolerate with their dogs. I have one case where the dog is redirecting on the owners, meaning the dog bites the owners when he gets overstimulated, something like the doorbell rings. A dog is biting them at a level 3 or level 4, which is basically puncture wounds. It's on the Dunbar bite scale, but it's basically puncture wounds, half the length or full length of the canine tooth, doing pretty good damage to these clients, two of which they had to go to the hospital for. And they are doing everything it takes in their power to keep this dog, to live with the dog, and to safely manage it. And this dog has bitten them over a half dozen times, and they were showing me all their scars. And and the dog also doesn't let go. It's a bite and hold case, so very very severe case that most clients I know would not be able to live with that for too long, if at all. And it's that's one extreme. And then I had another case where, the dog is just, is air snapping and has not made any contact, but the owner is just, first thing on her mind was euthanasia and getting rid of the dog and rehoming the dog, get this dog out of my house kind of mentality. And a lot of it is just, again, explaining to them what the reality in the case is and how to assess bite levels and why the dog is behaving the way they are. But then you have to dig a little deeper and find out maybe why is she this afraid of the dog. And when you can start to read into those things a little bit, it comes to find out she was attacked as a child by a dog, which I sort of gently ask those questions, but that's important to know. So on face value, we could be like, this poor dog, this lady just wants to get rid of it or euthanize, and all he's doing is air snapping because he's being pet while in pain. That was one of his underlying issues. And on face value, most of us would say, well, poor dog, but we also have to, understand that there's that client side of the coin that needs to be taken into consideration. So again, that empathy and listening to clients is really important.
Yeah, I like stories like that where it's so easy to judge, but then once you have information, you can have a huge perception shift just with that one piece of information.
Right.
Hey, thank you for sharing that. Before we move to the next question, just bring us up to speed, Michael. Tell us where people can go currently to find out more information about you and what you do.
I have my website. It's Complete Canines. It's like Complete, C-O-M-P-L-E-T-E, and Canines all spelt out, C-A-N-I-N-E-S.com. And that I have all my, clients can contact me there, but also I have my list of seminars and workshops and courses that I'm giving. And that can be all found on my website. I'm excited for. I've got the next season of the defensive handling workshop that Trish McMillan and I give, and that starts in 2019. I have two more locations this year, but then it starts in 2019 again. We have 10 cities we're doing next year. So,
awesome. Do you want to put a shout out to those cities so people know what to expect if they're listening?
Quite a few. Is LA, Los Angeles. There is New Orleans, San Francisco, Iowa City, a few others on the list, but it's all on the site. They'll be able to register for those if they want. If they want to learn about staying safe with aggression cases.
And we'll be talking about that very soon. And people can also find you and some of your content on IAABC. Is that correct?
I have a webinar on the, it's a 45-minute safety and defensive handling webinar that I did with Trish. That's available for on the IWBC website. It's free for members, and I think it's less than $20 for non-members. So,
and are you still active on Dog Trainers Connection?
Yes, I still have the course that I'm giving there, How to Work Aggression Cases A to Z. I'm in the middle of a course right now, and we usually run those every couple of months, 2 to 3 months. So the next start date hasn't been announced yet, but generally people can look for it to come out every 3 months.
Cool. And all of your touch points are on social media as well?
Yes. I just actually use my own personal Facebook page as my sort of duo personal slash business page. I've been too lazy to actually set up a business Facebook page, but people are more than welcome to friend request me on Facebook as well.
Oh, it's good to know that it wasn't my bad search skills which didn't lead me anywhere. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Michael. I love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, so very appreciated. Moving forward, I would really like to talk a bit now about your, we've already been talking about it, so let me rephrase that to say let's build upon talking about your work with aggressive dogs and focus on something you mentioned there. You've got a couple of courses and web classes on, and that is safety and handling. Can you please unpack this a little bit for us, Michael? Where do we start?
Yeah, so safety and defensive handling, that's something that actually Trish and I had discussed this. I had met her at an APDT conference about 7 years ago or so, but we had started talking about how on our Facebook feeds, we kept seeing people showing dog bites, meaning, and these are professional trainers, veterinarians, dog walkers, things like that. People were getting bitten, and it was coming across our Facebook feed. We had said to ourselves, you know, there's really not a lot of formal information about staying safe with handling aggressive dogs or avoiding dog bites in general. So we started with recording that little 45-minute webinar on the IWBC site, and that kind of grew into a one-day workshop, which then grew into a two-day workshop, which is what we're doing now. And we've been really fortunate. We've had a wonderful time doing it. We've done it in over 30 cities worldwide, 7 different countries. And it's just taken off because I think a lot of people want this information and need it, you know, and so we have about 10 cities we're going to next year so far. And it's just, and the people that come to the seminars are dog trainers, veterinarians, shelter staff, dog walkers, dog daycare staff, and a vast majority of them. In fact, I poll the audience every time. I actually do a little contest and I ask how many trainers have been bitten or how many attendees have been bitten. And it's usually about 75% of the audience have been bitten in a professional capacity. So not just by their own dogs or some dog on the street, it's in their line of work. And that speaks to something, that 3/4 of us are getting injured in our jobs. That's a lot of injuries, and some of them can be very severe. There's always at least one story from the audience about a severe dog attack or somebody being severely attacked, sent to the hospital, or worse in some of these cases. So it's if Trish and I always say, if we could just save one person from a dog bite at each seminar, we're doing our job. So that's kind of what it's about, the safety and defensive handling. We created it because we felt that there was a need for it, of course, but also we wanted just to keep people safe and stop seeing all those dog bites come across our Facebook feeds.
And so what kind of things do you cover in the 2-day workshop? And firstly, just acknowledge 75%, that's huge. That's a problem.
Yes. Yeah. We're actually more injury prone per capita than some of the most dangerous professions out there. And if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and at least in the U.S. here, we have more injuries than deep sea fishermen, lumberjacks, coal miners, some of the most dangerous professions. We actually get injured more as animal care professionals. So now, of course, our injuries aren't as severe as some of those professions. But there's something that needs to be said about that. Such a high percentage of people are being injured in this job, in this line of work. So So yeah, the two-day workshop now covers, there's a day on dog-to-human aggression and a day on dog-to-dog aggression. We not only cover safety and defensive handling, we also cover the aspects of behavior modification and training with these dogs in aggression cases. Trish is more on the shelter side of things. That's her world. She's got the expertise in the shelter world. So she approaches it from that angle, and I approach it from the behavior consultant angle. So it's kind of a nice mixed way of looking at dog behavior in different environments. We cover things from, you know, what to do if you're attacked by a dog, how to read dog body language in aggressive dogs, how to break up a dog fight safely. That's an interesting one too. It really surprised me when we started doing this, how little information or good information there is about how to break up a dog fight safely. And in fact, some of the worst injuries I've seen are from people breaking up dog fights. So it's very surprising that that isn't taught more. It's something that I think should be mandatory almost. It's just because almost everybody's going to come across a dog fight at some point in their life if they're living with multiple dogs or working in an environment with multiple dogs. So things like that, breaking up a dog fight, how to work with dog-dog aggression, how to work with leash reactivity, different safety tools, muzzles and things like that, different handling techniques. So as Trish likes to call it, leash origami, which is different ways of using a leash to secure an aggressive dog if necessary. And so it's quite a comprehensive workshop. And we like to cover a lot of different topics because of the sort of more broad audience, veterinarians and shelter and trainers and things like that. So it's packed with information for those that want to learn more about that.
So kind of we talked about why this workshop got started, brought us up to speed as to where we are now. Let's talk about in that middle space there. When you did that first web class, the 45-minute web class, was that titled Safety and Defensive Handling? And the reason I ask is because I'm just seeking some unpacking of that word defensive handling. What exactly do you mean by that term?
Yeah, so I if I remember correctly, it was called Safety and Defensive Handling, but defensive handling is just like defensive driving. So when we talk about people who are good defensive drivers, they don't get into accidents because they're constantly aware of their environment. They're doing all the right things while they're driving to stay safe. They're looking ahead. They're watching the guy on the cell phone. They're looking at that 18-wheeler swerving all over the road. Those are good defensive drivers. And the same can be said of a good defensive handler, is someone that is prepared and constantly aware of their environment. When working with an aggressive dog, they know what to look for. They know the signs of when a dog may bite. They are handling the leash correctly. They're using the right equipment. And so that's what defensive handling is. It can also, of course, be reactive handling in the sense that sometimes the dog does try to bite you, but we teach different leash skills and different techniques to what to do when you're attacked by a dog, which can, again, happen even if we take the most safest measures. We do want to be prepared for those times that it could happen.
Okay, and it makes sense. I've gone from 45 minutes to one-day workshops to two-day workshops, and we're trying to cover this now in like a 10-minute slot on a podcast. So acknowledging that, I made a bunch of notes here and I've got a bunch of different directions we can take before we move on. But for those working in the aggressive dog sphere, with clients of aggressive dogs, and with all you've learned over the years building this, and I'm sure you've got moving forward lots of different ideas about how you can turn it into a three-day workshop or however long, what are, let's say, two big takeaways that you've learned that you want everyone that's working with aggressive dogs to kind of pay attention to moving forward more, maybe considering that we're seeing a 75% bite rate?
Well, yeah, I guess a couple of the big takeaways, I'd have to think about this a second, but one of the big takeaways is you don't have to handle or physically interact with all dogs. And so just from most of us as trainers know, you just don't reach out and pet a dog when it doesn't want to be, if it's not showing any signs, or even if it is showing you signs, it's not always the best idea, and invading a dog's space. So the same could be said when working as a trainer with a client's dog. dog in the sense that, you know, we go in as trainers, the client calls us, we go in there and it's almost like this expectation sometimes for us to handle and work with the dog, get the dog on leash or do something with the dog physically to start to work on the problem. And that's sometimes an unrealistic expectation in some cases. And there's a lot of pressure on us as trainers and consultants to try to make that happen or try to make some improvement in the case. And part of that I've seen a lot of trainers fall back onto is that they're expected to work with the dog. But over the years, I've learned that there's some dogs it would be impossible in at least the first session to even get close to the dog. And so that's why a lot of what we can apply is similar to what they do in the zoo environments or with animals that you cannot handle using protected contact, using stationing, using training that doesn't require hands-on with the animal. And so that's the one thing I try to teach a lot of different skills that, okay, we can work with this dog, but I will never have to actually physically get close to the dog, maybe on the first or the second or the third session, because sometimes it's very dangerous to do so. So I think that's one big takeaway. You don't need to feel that pressure to get that leash the first time or get close to the dog or hand feed the treats or whatever it is to get in close proximity to the dog. That does not need to happen right away. In fact, it's often much better to wait and not put that pressure on the dog, not to invade their social space, that critical distance when we want to preserve how that dog feels about us in the first place. So that's one of the big takeaways, I think. Let me think on the second one. Second big takeaway is you don't have to work aggression cases. Aggression in dogs is sort of like the sexy thing, right? Everybody, whenever there's an aggression seminar or at a conference, you know, that room is always packed. But if it's something about intermittent reinforcement schedules, that room's a little empty. So I don't know. I don't think you really have to love it. You really have to love aggression cases because they can take their toll very quickly on you. Because you can get case after case after case of a poor outcome because they are so emotionally full of emotions and difficult decisions. You can get these string of cases where it's one bad outcome after the next, and that can really take its toll on you from a compassion fatigue sense. And we want to be certainly aware of that. Our profession has a high rate of that, so I think it's important that you don't have to take aggression cases if you especially if you're considering doing what I do, is take aggression cases, that you have to love them. So if you take them once in a while, even then, still consider, do you like doing it? You have to like doing it. So,
yeah, great inputs there. And I was thinking the same thing about in zoos, we wouldn't be looking to physically interact or handle those dogs. So I like that, and it's made me think about those cross areas where we can work together and learn from each other. Very cool. And then you talked about...
A lot of the things that they do in the zoo environments, you can take many useful things in those. Right, the stationing and targeting is one of the things that's is very, very useful in aggression cases, especially if you're working with dog aggression. I use stationing quite often, so it's I think this I love that, and that's one of the things I like about the IWABC is we have a lot of members from different animal behavior backgrounds, and it's a great way to that community is a great way to bounce ideas off each other, share this information that may not be found in different worlds. We all have our own little worlds we fall into, and so it's just learning those little tips and tricks it's invaluable, really.
And the other thing you talked about there, which transitions quite nicely into the next little segment that we wanted to touch on in this podcast and use this opportunity to talk about, is that sometimes you have a lot of pressure on you from clients. And you've got a lot of emotion in these clients, and sometimes we might place a label like difficult client on those situations. But you said you had some input and some offerings for the podcast listeners about ways that we can deal with difficult clients.
Yeah, I think as I've done this over the years, I've realized just how important that human side of the equation is. Because, you know, sort of a get off on a side tangent, I love that more trainers are specializing in things. So like you have Milena DiMartini, she's doing stress separation anxiety. And when you start doing that, you start to kind of get in the zone, you know. And so when I was jumping around and doing a lot of different things, taking a puppy client, then taking a separation anxiety case, then taking an aggression case, your mind is constantly switching gears from case to case. Versus if you're seeing the aggression cases, you start to really get a good feel and sense of what's going on, to where you don't need to think, sounds strange, but you don't need to think quite as hard as what the dog is doing, because you know how to change that behavior and to work on that behavior, versus if you're jumping around from different case to different case. So I think specializing is a really good thing to happen to the industry. But that's going to allow me to concentrate more on the human side of the equation, because I can often know just within a few sentences what the dog is doing and why the dog's doing what they're doing, just based on the behavior history. So now I can go and focus on what the client needs and how much information I can give them. You know, one of the things I've been really concentrating on too is how people learn, their learning styles. And so I'll try to assess that right in the beginning. And you can ask questions like, how do you like to learn? How do you like to process information? Do you like to write things down? Do you like to actually physically practice the mechanical skills? Do you like to watch somebody do it first? Do you like to hear it? Do you need to have notes? Do you need to take your own notes? So there's just those different learning styles, verbal, visual, social, logical, and so on and so forth. And so if we can assess that first to make it how we communicate with the client and how we're giving them that information and teaching them these skills, that can go a long way, because a lot of clients are going to have different learning styles and different ways of processing and how much they can process. So, the one thing we want to avoid is just going on and on and on talking to the client. And if they're not processing that information, we're kind of wasting our time. So I like to really assess that in the beginning. Another little trick, again, getting off on a little side tangent here, is I use my cell phone, or I ask the client to use their cell phone. And the beauty of modern technology is now, instead of writing down notes, they can take video of me working with their dog, or I can take video of them working with their dog, whatever the techniques are, so they can later go back and watch that and see the techniques. You can give them little messages too. Say, all right, Mrs. Jones, let me see your cell phone for a second. I will record myself saying, okay, this is what you're going to do later on. This is how many times. This is the repetitions. This is how you do it. And I'll just video myself using their phone. So, and think about the time saver too, like how much time you're saving versus having to write notes. So that's another little trick I've added to how I work with clients, is using cell phone technology. I actually do most of my follow-up and communication with clients using text messaging, which sounds strange to some people, I know, but it's worked out really, really well for me. So I think the human side of the equation is so important in aggression cases. And first and foremost, being empathetic, but also assessing how that client wants to communicate and learn. And then that often allows you to weed out that quote unquote difficult client factor. So it's not so much maybe a difficult client. It's just that we haven't figured out how to communicate properly with that quote unquote difficult client. So that's a big thing I've definitely added to how I do my consulting with clients these days.
Yeah, I think the using the cell phone idea is genius. Thank you for that one.
Yeah. That's I tell you, Ryan, it's a great way to keep track of your client info too. So a lot of us used to use like email, or we'd fill out our own forms in our, you know, our computers or whatever. It's just so much more efficient to do that, because it's all contained in one little text message string, and all of the photos that they want to send me, all of the video of them working with their dog while you're not there, they're sending that to you. And so I ask clients, just please send me a 30-second, 1-minute video of you doing the training with your dog so I can help you and fine-tune that if necessary. Just today, I got two great, great video updates from clients that both coincidentally have resource guarding dogs, but dogs that are guarding their food bowl. And they sent me these beautiful updates, the dogs responding really, really well. And that's, I wouldn't be able to see that happening if a client emails me and says, oh yeah, Mike, I'm working with my dog and he's doing really well. But what does that look like? So really well might look differently to different people. So allowing me to view them working with the dog, and it allows me to truly assess the training going on, the behavior change going on, versus something that's typed or even spoken to me in over the phone. I wouldn't be able to get a true picture of what's going on. So that's the beauty of those text message strings. And it's easy for me to find. I mean, it just saves, it's such a time saver for me.
Yeah, I love that. And the other thing that stuck out with me then, just because we did record a podcast a few weeks ago now with a friend of yours, Chris Spockle.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Chris.
And he talked about physically asking people how they want information given to them or how they want to learn. So that kind of beautifully gels with what you're saying there. Actually ask people how they want to learn.
Yes. Yeah. It's why wouldn't we? I mean, when you think about it, some people have a way, if whatever's going to make them process the information, why easier? Why wouldn't we ask that? It's just, you know, something that I don't know has been talked about enough in the dog training world.
There you go. If you're working with clients or with people, then just add that one small thing. It's such an easy thing to do. Just say, hey, how would you like to communicate?
Exactly. Yeah.
Is that the good question, or is there a way we can rephrase
that? I think that, how do you like to communicate? And also how do you process your learning? Or like, how do you like to learn? Do you like to read? And you can give them examples, because sometimes they're like, they look at you a little strange if you just ask, how do you like to learn? You kind of give them examples. Do you like to write notes? Do you like to do things physically? Do you like to watch first? Do you like to hear things, you know, auditory? So there's different ways of learning. Then they'll be like, oh yeah, I'd rather see you do it first, or I'd rather do the hands-on skills and taking notes. I hate reading. Sometimes they'll say that. So, yeah.
So one more question just before we move on, because one thing we've talked about today is emotions. And we've talked about, you just talked about labels in. What does a difficult client look like? It's going to be different for every person. And people listening to this podcast are hearing that, and everyone's got their own picture in their mind of what that looks like. But one thing that's going to be influencing potentially difficult clients is the level of emotion that is in that situation. What has been one thing that you've found in your experience that can bring emotionally driven, emotionally high situations kind of down to a level where information can actually be
received? So that's a great question, and one that I've focused on a lot also over the years. So I've actually, what I did was develop my own, like, so this prognosis list, and what I do, and that's just basically, it's kind of grown, but it's 18 different factors I assess on in terms of the seriousness of the case, because a lot of clients, they call me, and they have no idea what to do, and they kind of experience, they don't know, like they ask, you know, is my, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is my dog, or do I need to put my dog down, or what do you think I should do, how bad is my dog, is my dog a red zone dog, you know, quote unquote red zone dog. And so they have all of these ideas, and those questions are not yes or no answers. So what I do is I go through a list of objective points which we can measure. And I do it quickly. I don't spend too much time on it, but I do go through most of those points to assess just the severity of the case. So two things happen. It gives them an answer to their own question, like, how bad is my dog? How bad is this case? And it allows them to get a realistic overall picture of really what's going on. So it's, you know, some of the questions like the level of bite, how long they've had the dog's social history, the dog's breed, age, you know, factors like environmental factors, how are they able to manage it, who lives in the house, house, you know, the risk factors. Is it a dog that is biting children and they happen to live next to a school with 5 kids in the house? So you get weighing risk factors, the underlying medical history, if there's anything causing the behavior or exacerbating the behavior, I should say. And all of those factors, I go through that list with the client. One of the questions I will ask is, and assess is their, what's called, and Susan Friedman uses this really well, is their emotional bank account. And that's how much they have left in their tank to actually keep working with the problem. And you'll get, after you've gone through that prognosis list, because you can see them thinking as you're going through that list, you know, oh, on a scale of bite scale 1 to 6, your bite dog is biting at a level 2. That's great. So it's unlikely for it to jump to a level 6 any day, anytime soon. Yeah, there's, you know, it's predictable. The medical history looks good. He's had some training, and you get to that last step and you can see them. And it can go in one of two directions. They can be like, oh, you can see that, hear that sigh of relief. They're like, I guess it really isn't as bad as I thought. Or it could go in the other direction. They're like, wow, I really have a serious problem here. But the question to ask at the end of the prognosis is like, how are you feeling about all this now? After you've given them these key points, rather than just assuming that they're that quote unquote difficult client, or they're not being empathetic to their dog, or we have to look at the overall situation, the overall picture, and assess those factors, because everybody's going to have a different case in terms of what's going on in their life and also the dog's life. So how are you feeling is a great question to ask at the end of that. Also, have a box of Kleenex ready. And that, because a lot of clients do get emotional at that point of the consultation. But I think it's an important conversation to have with clients so they can really understand the overall picture of their case. And what's going on in with their dog's behavior. So that's a very, very helpful tool in a way to, again, assess, is your client truly, quote unquote, difficult, or is it something else going on in their life that you have to recognize and perhaps modify or understand and move on? Or, you know, what can we do to make it better for that client in that regard? So.
Yeah, fantastic. And I've got a ton of notes on my desk in front of me on a big sheet of paper, but I'm also conscious of time. So I'm going to say thank you so much for sharing. That was a lot of fun to learn about. Let's move on to our next question. And I'm excited about this one because it's not something we've talked about before much, if at all. I'm not sure. There's 60-something episodes now. I can't remember every single conversation, but I don't think we've talked about street dogs. Michael, you told me you've spent some time not only observing street dogs, but doing this across countries and in different cultures. I was hoping you might share with us a couple of things you've learned from these experiences.
Yeah, and it's this. I've been really fortunate and lucky to travel. I've been to 7 different countries over the last year, doing these seminars. And one of the things that I've really been had a lot of enjoyment is looking at the street dogs, observing their behavior, and observing the differences in the culture of dogs between different countries and how they view dogs, how they treat dogs, how they train dogs. You know, it's fascinating, and I think there's a lot to be learned from it as well in regards to culture. And so, you know, when you go to, as I will speak for Americans, since I live here in the U.S. and we kind of get stuck in our own shells sometimes when looking out the outside world. But I think it would be fascinating for some people to see just how dogs live in the rest of the world. And, you know, we have our culture here in the U.S. of dogs, and even differing cultures in the United States as far as how we view dogs and how we treat dogs. But it would be really, really fascinating for a lot of people, I think, to see how dogs live in other countries. So, for instance, you know, I live here in Connecticut, and if there was a dog, for instance, running around on the street off leash and just happened to be driving through a neighborhood and there's a dog off leash on the street, they would call out the National Guard to try to rescue this dog, because heaven forbid the dog is loose on the street. It's got to be lost. It's got to be saved. Somebody's got to rescue this dog. And it's amazing. I mean, like they've called, I've seen cases where they've called, like, you know, all of these volunteers and helpers and had like hundreds of people sometimes searching for a dog. Now, if you go to, for instance, Mexico, where I was last year, you're going to see dogs on the street all over the place, you know, all over the place. And these are dogs that are just, you know, hanging out, and they're on the street and nobody could care less. They're just It's like when you go to Central Park and you're walking by the pigeons and nobody's paying attention to the pigeons because there's pigeons everywhere. It's not a fascinating sight. It's just they're part of the environment. So the same thing in Mexico and some of the other South American countries is that the dogs are out on the street and nobody pays any attention to them. And that's just part of the culture. So the interesting thing, though, is how it affects behavior. One of the things that I really didn't see much of in those street dogs was aggression. You got these dogs, they're coming and going, walking by each other. And here in the States, we have a lot of problems with dogs, you know, coming after dogs, an off-leash dog maybe attacking your on-leash dog. There, I actually, a couple of the countries, I didn't see any aggression. And I saw hundreds of dogs in those countries. I couldn't see any instances of aggression happening. That's not to say they don't have that happening, but the percentage, I think, is much, much lower than what we have here in the States. And I think a lot of it has to do with the non-limitations on their environment, so they can come and go as they please. I mean, these dogs are living a great life. They're out on the streets. They're coming and going from... A lot of people actually own these dogs, and they just come and go as they please during the day, and they come back to the home at night, or they sleep in front of the house. But they're coming and going, and they're communicating with other dogs well. They're communicating with people well. People don't make a big deal about the dogs and try to pet them and you know, get in their space. They just sometimes they're just stepping over dogs that are just laid out in the sidewalk. And it's just the dogs are, there's the behavior issues or what we would consider behavior issues here is almost non-existent in many of the dogs there. Can they have fights? Sure, they happen. But most of the time, you're not seeing any of that same issue you have here where dogs with leash reactivity or the other typical behavior problems that we see here. So, but it's been fascinating watching the behavior of those dogs and, you know, what they compete over for resources is different sometimes. You know, the food is plentiful in a lot of the areas. you would think that they would be, you know, street dogs, poor dogs, they're going to be starving. But most of the time, these dogs are actually, a lot of them are overweight because they're experts at scavenging and begging from tourists in some of the touristy areas. So, it's also interesting to me how the culture of dog training and behavior in general is so different in so many places. And I think that's something we can really learn by observing that, because with social media, as you know, these days, there's a lot of quick sniping or criticism when we see somebody doing something that might not match up to our, you know, quote unquote standards. But we have to realize that, again, we're just a product of our experiences in our environment and our educational offerings, what we can get access to. And, you know, so we use crates here in the US. In some countries, they don't use crates at all. They're just unheard of. And I've heard from other trainers and some of those, like when I was in Barcelona, they're just like, you guys use crates? That's just really strange. And, you know, so if they were on the Facebook group here discussing things and somebody says, well, you need to crate train your puppy that needs a house training, or, you know, it's just unheard of. And so, and versus we might be saying, oh, you can't use that, you know, that method to train that dog. Or it's just, I think there's a lot to be learned, because it's the culture that really matters, the culture of where that dog or that trainer is in terms of the dogs. It's just so I'm going off on a tangent a little bit there, but I think you get the idea. I think it's something that people should do, is just get out and experience more of the different dog cultures, dog training cultures, get out from behind that computer and see some dogs in other areas. Yeah.
All right. And just conscious of the time, but just curious to ask you, considering your main area is aggression, and you're in these countries like Mexico, and you're saying you're not seeing any aggression in the time that you were there with the dogs that you saw, what takeaway, to build on what you've said, what takeaway can we then bring into America and think about how we're managing our dogs?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that question because, you know, that's a big point I stress is, you know, we see dogs, for instance, and this drives me crazy sometimes, and I probably catch some flack for this, but we have rescues pulling dogs from the street. So we see somebody will be vacationing in Puerto Rico or something, and they take this dog that's probably lived its whole life on the street, and in the name of rescuing it, they take it off the street. They stick it on a cargo plane overnight, and it's just a scary experience. The dog's never been on a plane. So they're flying over here, terrified. They get off the plane. Somebody snatches the dog off the plane, and they put it on a transport, maybe for another 12 hours in a truck somewhere. And then they get to the that transport area, and then they have to, of course, pass the in the States, they have laws about dogs being shipped, so they have to do the, you know, immediate vet check. And so they're getting poked and prodded. Oftentimes, they're getting neutered or spayed, so they're going right under the knife. I think about that string of terrifying events. And then what do? We take that dog and we put it in a house, and the owner goes off to work 8 hours a day or 9 hours a day, and they put it in a crate or stick it in a small room because they're not sure, because the dog's probably not house trained because it's lived on the streets, and it's probably going to chew things because it's, again, experienced life just free roaming. And just think about how that's going to affect behavior. And so we see, I think one of the major problems we have here is lack of enrichment, lack of, you know, too many restrictions on environment. And, you know, and I'm speaking within reason. Of course, we need things like leash laws. And of course, we need restrictions on what we're going to allow our dogs to do here. But those restrictions can be taken to the extreme, and especially in aggression cases. You know, the people will sequester their dog more and more in an aggression case because of it helps to avoid the problem. So, but what happens is the dogs suffer from lack of enrichment. You know, you have to assess that. Their quality of life and welfare comes into question when you're socially isolating dogs like that. So, you know, certainly we all know that what happens to shelters, dogs in shelters through long-term confinement. So, you know, I think that's something that really needs to be looked at, is like, if you have these dogs that are, I think it's a culture shift needs to happen in terms of how we're using so many restrictions on environments, you know, and you're probably aware of this too. In other countries on your side of the world, there's much, the places that dogs can go is much more, they're much more available. So cafes and restaurants and public transportation and all those things that that are restricted more heavily here can play a role on behavior. So I think that was one of the big takeaways I got, is just how much lack of enrichment can affect behavior, lack of social stimulations. As we know, canines are social animals, so that lack of social experiences can also be detrimental. So yeah, we have a lot to learn from other cultures, I think, at least in how we work with dogs here in the United States.
So acknowledging that in your workshops, you've got about 75% of people who are experiencing dog bites. So firstly, we know we've got a problem. Secondly, there are, from your observations, differences between levels of aggression in countries that manage their dogs differently and have different cultures. And one possible takeaway is the amount of limitations that dogs have in different cultures and the ways they're managed. And sometimes it could be culture, and the culture and the limitations come from a lack of resources on behalf of the owners. And we're calling these things behavior problems, but they're potentially resource problems, and we need to kind of figure out how to best leverage what we have. We're at work 8 hours a day. We've got limited money. We've got limited time. So many factors to consider there. We just touched on so many different points. But what advice do you have for people? What is a takeaway? What is a takeaway from everything we've just had the pleasure of listening to you share with us?
Yeah, that's so. Yeah, there are a few points that we could touch upon there. I think you know, in terms of behavior, the reason why we're seeing so much aggression, that could be something we could touch on first, is why we're seeing so much aggression in the U.S. and so many cases, where it's a source problem as well. So we're getting lots of dogs in the name of rescue, and we're pulling dogs from situations or breeding situations where there's going to be you're going to increase the risk of behavior problems. So you know, we're getting rescue dogs that are poorly socialized, or puppy mill dogs poorly socialized. We're getting dogs that you know, with questionable breeding, and so I think a source problem, because we are spay and neutering a lot of the good dogs out of the gene population, and so we're kind of getting left with a lot of dogs with potential for aggression. So I think that's one major issue we need to address, is where are we getting the dogs from in the first place? And, you know, and then with regards to the sort of culture here of how we, you know, restrict dogs, I think that also needs to be looked at. So people with limited time, limited resources, you know, you often faced with having to be creative, but that's not to take away from the dogs. Many dogs can be very resilient and are capable of handling that kind of lifestyle, but I do think, you know, people that are working 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day should first consider that as part of their decision-making process, and what kind of breed they get and what kind of dog they get. But also, I think there's lots of creative ways to make the dog stay enriching. And I'm sure you've had guests on the show talk about enriching and enriching the environment, giving the dogs enrichment activities. I think it's certainly reasonable to incorporate those things to increase or improve the dog's quality of life. But so for people with aggressive dogs that have to deal with that, now you're limiting what they're able to do. So that's where you have to get creative sometimes. So for instance, the dog that barks and lunges at other dogs on walks, or barks and lunges at people on walks, does the dog really benefit from the walks? That's a question to ask. And can we replace that activity with something else? Can it be play with the owner? Could it be nose work in the backyard? You know, what else can we do to enrich that dog's day, to provide the mental and physical stimulation it needs without exposing the dog to the stimuli that that's giving the owners a hard time in the first place? Not to say we don't want to work on that behavior, but there's other opportunities in terms of with clients with limited resources and time that can be incorporated, I think, for sure. So, kind of a multi-part question there. And I think, I'm not sure if I answered all of it, but yeah, because I could keep talking about the reasons for, I think, the increased amount of aggression or the reason why we're seeing so much aggression in the dogs in the United States. But
I didn't really see you up for success with the way I asked that question, and we're really pushing the boundaries of time on this episode because I just have so many questions. But let's have the takeaway potentially be, and tell me if you agree or disagree or want to build upon this takeaway, one word: creativity.
Yeah, I like it. We can always be creative, and you have to be with aggression cases, because of the limitations and the safety aspects and risk that we need to assess as well.
Well, that was fantastic information, and I know that there's loads of people who listen to the show who are going to find this, firstly, really interesting, and secondly, be able to take the information and ideas forward with them in their work. So thank you so much for sharing. Next, I'd love the opportunity, even though recently, as mentioned in your bio, you've stepped down from your role as president of the IAABC. I'd love to hear about you, with regards to this wonderful organization, about your time there and what the IAABC offers its members.
Yeah, so the I joined as a member, I think, about 9 years ago. Don't quote me on that. 8 or 9 years ago, I joined. I joined as a supporting member because I was learning about dog behavior, and I wanted to learn more. So I love the community aspect of it. As soon as I joined, I was just blown away because they had those Yahoo group forums back then, but again, all of these behavior consultants and trainers, and I started to recognize the name. I'm like, wow, I read that guy's book, or I read that woman's blog, and it's all of these really high level people working in the animal behavior world, and not just with dogs. And so that alone was what got me hooked into the IAABC, and then I started to volunteer more. I actually was recruited to help with the application process and developing the application for certified consultants, which led me to joining the board of directors. And then I was a member of the board for a year. Then I was elected president of the board after that. So I was on the board as president for 5 years, 5 terms. And that's kind of where my path went through the IWC. But I love the organization. It's just the level of membership in terms of their knowledge as a community is something I have not found anywhere else. And that's where I've been. I really, really learned so much from the community there. And I call it a community because it is exactly that. It's a collection of people all looking with a common interest in animal behavior and elevating the profession. And I learned so much from all of those people over the years. So I can't thank all of the members enough for helping me grow in my career path and also my knowledge of animal behavior. There's plenty of benefits for members. There's recordings for conferences and courses all in their user accounts. And that's just one of the many benefits. So you get the educational aspect of it. You get the community aspect of it. And if those interested want to become certified, if they have a background in behavior, they can certainly apply for associate or full certification through the organization. And it is multi-species, so I know you are a multi-species podcast show, so we do have dogs, cats, horses, parrots, working animals, and we also have the shelter division. So quite a few options for people interested in behavior and working with behavior consulting with clients.
Need added an exotic section to that list.
I will just nod my head. You can see me nodding it, but yes, potentially in the works, maybe.
And so one thing you mentioned there, which I think will be of interest to a lot of people that listen to the show, is the certification process. And for people that are interested in gaining some sort of certification, obviously the IAABC is one option that you have. Can you just explain to everyone what is involved in becoming a certified IAABC member?
So we have two different levels. We have associate certified and full certification. Associate certified is for those working with animal behavior, generally about 2 to 3 years, we recommend. We don't have any actual strict guideline, requirements, I should say. So we don't look for a log of consulting hours. We just suggest those as guidelines so people will know when they're ready to take the application. So associate certified, 2 to 3 years of behavior consulting experience, 300 hours or so of working with clients in behavior problems is what we recommend for that. And for full certified, we look at 5 years, 500 or 600 hours of consulting experience to have before taking the application. And that's just, again, general guideline, because we like to see people be successful at the application. And if you haven't been doing it quite that long or haven't had that much experience, you might not do as well on the application. So it's all essay based, and we ask for case studies, previous cases that you've worked with from start to finish. We present different scenarios. So I could say, hey, Ryan, I've got this dog, and it's a case with a dog that's guarding its food bowl and it's biting the owners. What questions would you ask to get more information about the case? What would your initial recommendations be? And so that's the scenario part of the exam. And we have questions on learning theory and definitions and things like that, medication questions. And again, it's all essay based, and it's basically open book. You have 60 days to complete it at your own time. And the application review committee uses what's called a rubric that will score your application based on your responses. And it's kind of like, you know, if you were a mechanic taking an exam for the Certified Mechanic Association, it would be the same thing. Like, hey, Ryan, there's this car guy. He brought his car to you. It's not starting. What would you check for? And the rubric would say, Ryan said, I would check the battery. I would check if there's a key in the ignition. I would check to make sure there's gas in the car. And so the same thing we look for when you're approaching your cases is, are you checking all those boxes in a way that a consultant would in that type of case? So it's meant to be stringent and difficult, but we of course want to keep it a prestigious certification. So it's a lot of applicants kind of compare it to writing their master's thesis if they do have a master's degree. So just to give you an idea of the work and the time that goes into it.
And where can people go to find out more
about this? They can go to IAABC or IAABC.org, and all of the information is on the website. They can look under it's called the Join tab, and under there is where the certification information is.
Thank you so much for all of us, Michael. Sadly, we are nearly at the end of this episode, but that's okay because we're also heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show, and this is story time. Michael, you've already done so, but could you please maybe share one more story from your experience training and working with dogs / animals so far and an important lesson that that story taught you?
All right. I will share the story of a recent case that I'm actually working on now. One that I'm sharing actually with Dr. Chris Pockle, who you've had here. He's helping me with the medical side of the case, referring to the vet. He's working with the client's veterinarian. But it's one that really speaks volumes about what I think behavior consultants and trainers should know in aggression cases, and that is how to recognize pain in dogs. We're often, especially of us working on behavior and the applied behavior analysis mindset, we're looking at behavior a lot, but we've got to make sure we're assessing the intrinsic part of the animal, and that can be pain. In fact, this case, the client had hired a couple other trainers that came on board before me. The second trainer was working with a dog. I don't want to call him a traditional trainer, but he was using like a sort of a light collar correction using a martingale collar. And this dog, guess whose first bite this dog was to? It was to the trainer. And which isn't unheard of, but when I went to, here I am as a third trainer on the case, I go in to see this dog, and the first thing I see is this dog just moving very stiffly. So walking where I was meeting the dog outside for the first time, and the dog is just moving. It is almost like it was in a straitjacket. So it's just the dog's limbs were moving very stiffly. The neck was very stiff. And I said to the client, have you ever had this dog, assessed or examined by the vet for potential underlying pain issues? She's like, no, he's been to the vet, but just for a general health check. And so that's what she did. She took the dog to the vet and mentioned that, hey, my trainer said, to just assess for underlying maybe pain issues or issues that could be exacerbating the behavior. And sure enough, this dog ended up getting x-rays and had scoliosis of the spine in two areas. It had to have 9 teeth removed because of rotting teeth issues and cracked teeth issues. It had an incredible ear infection. And so you can imagine how this dog felt when the previous trainer was giving it, even albeit minor collar corrections, on an area that's just so sensitive to pain. And so that was really something that I've been focusing a lot on lately, is making sure we're recognizing signs of pain or when to refer to a vet to rule out any underlying medical issues. And that's especially in aggression cases, because there's so many times it can be exacerbated or caused by an underlying medical issue. So I think as behavior consultants and trainers, that is an area we should at least be somewhat knowledgeable in, so we can know when to refer to a vet. I'm not saying we need to, of course, unless you're a veterinarian, you should not be diagnosing these things, of course, right? And I stress that point a lot, is we don't want to step on the veterinarian's toes, but we can certainly say, we can say to the client, talk to your vet about potential underlying medical issues that could be having an effect on the behavior. So that's kind of my big lesson of late. And Dr. Chris has been really helpful as well in that regard. Get good at recognizing those underlying issues that you would want to refer to a vet for.
Yeah, and great story to include in this podcast and nicely tie into the fact that this will be an episode or two after Chris's episode. So good for the learners to go on this journey and be able to link those back to each other. So we'll link to in the show notes as well, Dr. Chris Bockel's episode as well, for anyone that wants to go and listen to Chris's input, because it builds really nicely on that. Thank you so much, Michael, for sharing everything today and that story. You definitely didn't disappoint with that great story there. Sadly, this does bring us now to our final question for this episode. Could you please move forward now and take us all into the future and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years? The question I've got in front of me says in the animal training world, but let's focus in a little bit. What would you like to see happen in the next 5 to 10 years in the dog aggression for lack of a better word, community. I mean, I don't think that's the right word to use, but we'll go with that.
Okay. So this is can be a little controversial in the in some areas, but I would love to see some sort of regulation or licensing happen for dog trainers. It just, especially in aggression cases, when you think about it, we require our licensing here for hairdressers, but we don't require licensing for someone to come in and work with your dog with the potential for serious risk or injury to others, to people in the home or to other animals. We're talking about decisions in some of these cases that may require euthanasia for the dog or could result in euthanasia or worse for the dog if the trainer or consultant is giving bad advice or doing the wrong thing. So, and I've seen that many, many times. I've taken a lot of cases with clients that they had worked with a previous trainer, and that trainer had done some things that were very questionable and risky, but also in some cases have made the behavior worse. So I would love to see something, at least a bare minimum standard. I'm not saying we need to have very thorough exams to start with, but to just some bare minimum that says, it's amazing. Here in Connecticut, you can actually have been convicted of felony animal abuse and still work with actual dogs. And that has happened in Connecticut, where a trainer was arrested for hoarding dogs in horrific conditions, but she is still allowed to train dogs. There's something wrong with that picture, and that needs to change. And so I think a lot of trainers would agree with me in terms of being able to at least have some minimum standards in place to prevent those things from happening, and certainly having a minimum standard of best practices for working with animals.
And so what, in your eyes, are some steps that we need to take as a community, or that we can just start to think about?
Yeah, so it's got to it's generally, when you're talking about licensing, it's got to happen at the local level first. So it would be next to near impossible to do a nationwide licensing, but it's actually happened in a couple of communities in the United States, and that's where I think it should start, is at the local level, and then gradually expand to the state level in areas. And again, looking at just the minimum standards, looking at the simple things like, have you ever been convicted of animal cruelty? Yes. Well, sorry, you can't train animals for a living. That's just the basic understanding dog health requirements, having insurance, having liability insurance, things like that should be in place. And that's a good way to start. So getting together with, local trainers in your area, forming a group, approaching the, local government in terms of passing those kind of laws, and then moving forward with it. It is a process, I will say. I have done some research on it. It is a process, and it takes a lot of effort, but I think in time it's inevitable, I should say, at some point. So if you want to say in how things go, then to become involved in it is important.
Have you got groups started in Connecticut?
Action there? We don't have action on it yet, but we do. Yes, we do have a group of us that are, have talked about it. It's just, again, it's a lengthy process, and it takes time, and it takes the right people too. You have to have some knowledge of how to get these things passed, and it's a learning curve. So,
Well, if you're out there in a situation where you have had success, then let us know, and please share it so we can learn from each other as well. Because
I would love to. I appreciate that too. Yeah,
it's so great. And we did this at the start of the episode and throughout, but just before we do officially wrap up, can you just remind everyone listening, Michael, where they can go to find out more about you, what you do, and if wanting to get in touch?
Everything can go right to my website. That's the easiest way to find me. It's again, completecanines.com, completecanines.com. And of course you can friend request me on Facebook, Michael Shikashio on Facebook. I'd be happy to accept anybody's friend request. And those are the two easiest ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. And as mentioned, we will link to all of that in the show notes. Hey, Michael, this has been a ton of fun. So from myself and on behalf of everyone listening out there, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
It's been, like I said, a ton of fun. And we, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. If you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join our tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks again, everyone, so much for listening, and you will hear from us again soon.